Welcome to another...
The official podcast of The Leaky Cauldron.
The Leaky Cauldron.
The Leaky Cauldron.
Do you hear that, Earth? The Leaky Cauldron.
Just go! You're wasting time!
Welcome to Pottercast, the official podcast of The Leaky Cauldron, your number one source for theories, news and discussion, and interviews from the books and the films like me, Rupert Grimm. I play Ron Weasley in the Harry Potter films. And now your host, John and Sue.
Does everybody know what time it is?
It's Pottercast time!
Everybody grab your tools, because it's time. Just kidding. It's Pottercast, guys, episode 124, and we're going to have a heck of a week, because this is... a podcast without our fearless leader. What's her name?
Melvin Marvish.
Melvin! I'm going to use that from now on. We're going to give Melvin a call and tell her how we did. But this is without Melvin. This is John.
And this is Sue.
We are talking about Harry Potter and everything else this week. It's going to be a fun time. We've got lots of segments that I'll tell you all about after we hear from our favorite bookstore friends at Borders.
Haven't read Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows yet? Don't worry, Borders is here to help. Pick up your copy of this summer smash hit soon. You won't be able to hide from the spoilers forever. You can count on Borders to have it in stock and ready to take home tonight, along with the audiobook version. Even if you've read the book, the Harry Potter fun doesn't have to end yet. Visit BordersMedia.com or click on the Borders banner at the top of the Pottercast page to find out more.
Awesome, awesome. And if you've managed to hide from spoilers this long, you're a better man than I, because... hell, I think I survived the spoilers up until 2 hours before midnight.
I know.
The night the book came out. And I just couldn't stay off the comment boards. Well, yeah, well, when Joe names a character after you, you're dying to tell the world about it, so.
That's pretty much true. That was pretty awesome.
That killed me. I'm sorry. I appreciated Joe, but that post, the comments, was what spoiled me, sad to say.
So you're blaming Joe. You're blaming Joe.
Oh, I know. I'm always quick to blame somebody.
I know.
Sorry. But an awesome show, even sans Melissa.
Mm-hmm.
We have a Scrippy 5 with our lovely, lovely Scrippy gals.
Mm-hmm.
And we're back with Canon Conclundrums, recorded early in the week before the madness with Mr. Van Der Ark.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a bit by bit, taking the canon bits at a time.
Yay.
What's the topic this week, Sue?
Oh, we love those crazy seven. That number seven is back with the seven Potters.
Woo-hoo.
Everybody, watch your pants. We're putting on seven Harrys. And we've got, on top of that, the Phoenix Files, where we take, similar to Bit by Bit, a bit of the Order of the Phoenix film at a time.
And we talk about one of our, I'll say it, one of my favorite
people,
actresses. Her name is Yvonne Lynch, and we talk about Luna.
Who's here to join us this week? A special guest! The Thestral!
The Thestrals are here!
Sorry, not Yvonne Lynch. The Thestrals are here in the form of our favorite assistants, the senior staff, Lizzie and Chloe, who will be our guest hosts of the week, so it's not just Crazy Sue and I the whole week.
No.
But they do a great job. You'll hear from them soon.
Uh-huh.
That's the show and a half for you right there.
Yeah.
I guess we could talk about the news, right?
We do have news. Guess what, everyone? It's official now. We've seen it. The official photos of Hagrid's hut have now surfaced.
It's back. How big's the hot tub?
There's no hot tub.
Oh, what the hell are they doing? Are they sleeping in the hot tub called Deathly Hallows?
I don't know. Poor Hagrid, man. He's just living out on the hot tub action, I guess.
Yep, my hut returns with Hagrid's hut getting yet another makeover. Actually, it doesn't look that much different now this time,
though. No, it doesn't, but...
I'm very disappointed.
I know.
I wanted, like, aluminum siding or something.
You know, I was too. And this is a question, because this kind of ties into another thing.
Okay.
So, now, we saw the first... There's, like, three or four photos of this hut being built. And we've also had a wonderful feature from a company named Rising Sun out of Australia. And they do some of the special effects. And they did the thing about Harry, but they also showed how they took a shot of the trio running down the hill, and they added in Hogwarts, but then they added in Hagrid's hut.
Interesting. It's just, a matter of locations. And I guess they just didn't have that sort of hill nearby where they made the hut, which is kind of silly because they're moving that hut every dang time.
Yeah.
So they could just move it to a hill if they wanted near a hill, but...
I'm
not the master of this stuff yet. Maybe one day.
We will be, though. For those that don't know, John is studying...
An aspiring
visual
effects student.
But it's very, very time-consuming, very meticulous, very painstaking work that these companies do.
Yeah.
And what was neat about this feature is that you can actually see they have it on their website. We have links on our website.
It's really, really cool. Put that stuff on the DVD, guys. Come on. All the other big effects movies usually have that stuff in there. Where's that cool stuff? Thank you so much. Rising Sun, was it, you said?
Yes, it was. And they put...
For doing that. It was so cool. Yes, I'll check it out.
Yeah, definitely. I mean...
Do it for everything else so I can learn how you did it.
Yeah.
I actually have a better idea about that stuff
Yes,
now.
Give us all of your secrets now.
We shall do the movie for you. Only on podcast.
I know. And speaking of movies, I do have to commend, we have had our readers, as we talked about last week, but filming was taking place in Laycock in Wiltshire, England, and they did the scene where Harry and Dumbledore apparate outside of Slughorn's home, where he's hiding at the beginning of the book.
Yes.
Yes. And so we've had so many fantastic reports from readers who went to the scene and wrote down all these details, and they sent in these fabulous pictures, and we had them first, and I just want to say thank you. Rock. Leaky readers rock. So that was amazing.
Hey, Sue, do you know why they're filming that part of the film now?
No. Why?
Because they can!
But I thought it was neat. What was neat in the photos that we were talking about, that Dumbledore was wearing a cast on his hand, and we're just talking about special effects. They're actually going to put that in, right, John?
They are. They are going to add that in. I presume, if not for every shot, at least it looks like some of the shots were going to have a digital replacement for his gross hand.
You know, doesn't it give you hope that when you hear these details about, you know, them saying, you know, here's Dumbledore with his withered hand. I mean, they could have just done away with that. There's no need for them to put that in there.
They could have just, you know, painted it black with finger paint or something, but they actually have millions of dollars in their budget, so they don't have to do crap like that. Look at them. Congratulations. What else is going on?
Oh, well, speaking of, I have to say this because Mr. Gambon has given another interview, and he's so...
Oh, yes. Poor guy.
Please.
I think there's like 5 stages of, you know, dealing with Gambon. First of it is like, what the heck was that? Then it was like anger, like, oh my God, did he just do that? And then confusion is like, why did they let that in? And then it's like, oh, this poor guy doesn't read the internet. He doesn't know what the hell he's doing is wrong.
I know, but...
So it's like, the poor guy, what did he say? He doesn't even watch his movie.
He doesn't watch his movies. He hadn't watched the Harry Potter films.
Oh.
And he, you know, he's like, oh, wait, I might have seen one. Oh, okay, thanks.
I mean, that's like Joe saying, like, oh, I wrote the book, but I've never read them.
You know, the man is an excellent actor, and he did a fabulous turn on play. He did that one. He didn't even speak a sound.
I'm starting to have to develop more theories about this whole thing.
Oh, no.
It's like, you know, you got somebody on set like Michael Gambon, and granted, you've got all kinds of talented British actors out there, but who's the person on set that you think is going to be more reserved about giving too much direction to? Probably the guy who's going to be, you know, 20 years older than anybody else over there.
Right.
Who's going to be doing this for longer than anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And he told him, you're going to be an old wizard. You know, he's going to be like, Michael Gambon, Michael Gambon, Michael Gambon. He'd be like, Arrestrio Momentum! Michael Gambon, Michael Gambon, Michael Gambon.
Yes.
So...
Yeah.
There's only so much we're going to get from this guy. And considering what we found out about Deathly Hallows, like I said before, I like this Dumbledore better than the hippie love Dumbledore that so many people thought he was before Deathly Hallows came out. So, rock on, Gambon. It's okay. You don't need to watch the movies. We're watching them plenty for you.
Yeah, we got enough. We'll track you enough. But they just, you know, when he gives these interviews, you just... I mean, I actually cringe every time one of these pops up, and I just think, oh, no, please, please don't let him say this. But then...
Yeah, I just want him to wear a new dang outfit just for once.
No.
Does he have other clothes?
No.
Does this poor guy just have his own purple uniform he wears all the time?
Well, we learned that he was a stylish guy, like, in the books. I mean, he had, like, a red suit or something, you know. Or
tell me what 117-year-old gay man only has one outfit. Explain this
to me. I don't know. Most, regardless of what they are, their sexuality, people have more than one attire. Although,
exactly.
Look at Sirius Black, you know, the whole time. He didn't bother to get a new...
Hey, he rolled it with that fur robe.
Oh, that's
Right, and we'll naked underneath, though, but he was still had it. That's true.
Well,
I guess that's
you
true.
Know, when you're spending half your life as a dog and running around naked anyway, you probably don't have too much attachment to your clothes.
Well, I'm not going to complain about
I...
You know, okay, I'll be good. Okay, we're moving on. Oh, and speaking of people dressing, there is a stylish dress doll now that you can own, John.
Is it?
Boldy Wears Prada, baby.
Oh, my God. They decided to reinforce their decision of putting him in a suit by immortalizing it in a doll.
In a doll.
It's awesome. I've always wanted to dress up Voldemort, to be honest. I had dolls growing up that I mostly just, you know, took their clothes off and made them, you know, kiss each other or pull their heads off like most boys do with their sister's dolls. No, you can do it with Voldemort, and it's great.
Yeah, I mean,
awesome. Did they have other dolls out like this, similar to this, that you can make them interact with?
They do. Well, they have Tonner makes these high end dolls, and we've had several of them. We've had Harry and Ron Hermione, but this one of Voldemort. I mean, he's got the whole black suit on.
Oh my gosh!
He's got the dress, patent leather shoes. I mean, you know, the whole thing. But I mean, who wants a sharp dressed Dark Lord? Maybe not. I don't know. $150
for
that
scary.
Thing too. I'm like, come on.
He's like, I'm going to an interview with Voldemort. I will then kill the guy if I don't get the job. Why do we need to? He hates Muggles. He hates Muggle clothes too.
Why would he be throwing up in the Prada suit?
You know,
I don't know. Maybe.
I mean, what's his face? Archie here, who you know knew so little about Muggles, he wears a dress to the Quidditch World Cup.
Yeah.
You got somebody like Voldemort who utterly despises Muggles, but is very fashionable in their fashion. He gets it. He may like to torture them, but Lord help him if he doesn't know what the best suit to wear is.
I guess Bella must have helped him pick that out, I guess.
Yeah,
she
dressed him nicely.
Okay, there is one more piece of news that's kind of fun, that Miss Jo has not actually done writing. She's actually...
No, look at her. She decided, I'm going to tell everybody that I'm done writing books, but I'm going to secretly write Beetle and the Bard.
Beetles of the Bard, do-do-do. And not only did she write them... But she didn't write it for everybody. She just wrote.
Yeah, that's no fair. No. Come on. No one likes a click. Nobody likes to be like, neener, 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 I wrote a book and you're not allowed to read it unless you have $1 million to spend at Sotheby's.
Yeah. Jo has written, handwritten these long books by hand.
Yeah.
And she is auctioning one off for charity. I think it's in December 13th is the date. And they put this encrusted in jewels and everything.
Yeah.
I mean, whoo-hoo, but...
So is it time to start the Get a Beetle campaign on Leaky?
You know, people actually said that right away. They're like, oh, can we do that?
You know? Well, seriously, I mean, it's like, you know...
Yeah.
But I would have much rather had a Beetle in the Bard book than a 93-word card.
Yeah, I think I would have.
And isn't that money going to charity anyway?
Yes.
That they
all the money
that Sotheby's is getting.
Yes, all the money is from the charity itself is going to that Children's Voice. It was that children's high level group that she started about the terrible about the children in the cages, and it was just a
how much did we raise for the first Kid of Clue? Roughly,
I don't know, 30-something thousand. Oh,
30-something.
I don't know. It's probably more than that. Don't quote me on that because I don't know offhand.
Yeah.
But we raised a lot, but it wasn't enough. I mean, we got outbid like in like 2 seconds or something crazy.
Oh, well, it was the thought that counted.
Yeah, but I don't know. This will, you know, I mean, they're hoping to raise huge amounts of money for this. But can I just say this, though? If fans are interested and they think, oh, we're never going to get this, you know, and stuff, that Sotheby's also has a 48-page catalog that has images and a thing from Joe and excerpts and kind of stuff from the book that you can buy.
Yeah.
And all that money from that will go to the same charity as well. So, and we have links for that on our website, which is really cool. So,
that's cool. Yeah,
so you can do that, too.
I mean, I just can't imagine that we're not eventually going to get this thing in some form.
I think she will.
I mean, the nice, cool thing about her is that she's, like, hand-drew illustrations for these, and they've, like, got jewels on the front. I mean, that'll make them valuable in and of itself. But to deprive us of, you know, Joe's written word like this, more than a 93-word card, is just cruel and unusual, especially making it so public. Like, fine, if you want to make things for your friends, you know, do it. But it's like going to class one day and being like, hey, you six over here, you're coming to my awesome Super 16 party.
Yeah.
And everybody else is like, cool, you're having a party. And they're like, oh, you're not invited, sorry.
Yeah.
But I'm going to talk about it all over the place.
Yeah, I think
I think eventually, I mean, you know, maybe it'll come out future. She's retaining, like she said, the publishing rights to the books. So I think maybe, I mean, the article's never said on Joe, never said on her website, she's never going to release this in the future.
Yeah.
She did not say those words specifically.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Who knows? It could be included in the encyclopedia.
Yeah.
Who knows how long this book is, you know?
You know, exactly.
Did she say how long the book was?
I think it's like 140 pages long.
Holy God, are you kidding? I thought it was like...
No.
It's Dr. Seuss kind of...
But, you know, but if you look at the pages, she did an interview with BBC, and we have that in our galleries. You can watch it. But you can see some of the pages. And even the pages are really, like, the amount of information on are not really long. So,
oh, okay. Yeah.
You know,
so it's kind of like Dr.
It's just a tale of all the different things that if you haven't read the book, but it's mentioned in the book and it has all the different tales from the Deathly Hallows stuff and the little fairy tale thing that, you know, from Hermione or whatever.
Yeah.
And, I think there was something else going on.
Well, we did just briefly touch on encyclopedia. It is a giant pink elephant in the room and in the fandom. You know, guys, we're not really going to talk about it all too much because it's a serious thing that's going on with the lawsuit now between Joe and WB and our friend Steve from Lexicon and the Canic and Conundrums. You know, you're probably not going to hear anything public now from either the two of them. It's going to have to be settled and dealt with in the proper channels. But, you know, for our part, we wish the situation be resolved as fairly and hopefully as quickly as possible, because it's, you know, it's a tough thing. I mean, even looking at it as you got a good friend like Steve, and, you know, we at Leaky would like to consider Joe as a good friend too. So whenever you see, you know, two friends getting into it, it's a tough thing.
Tough.
We're going to wish everybody involved the best. And again, hopefully we get a quick and fair resolution for everybody.
We do have information about the suit on our website. We have the actual entire suit. If you would like to read that, we have the links. We also have the response from the publishers, and that information is there.
Yeah, I mean, as far as Leaky's role in this, all we're going to do is, you know, give the fans what we continue to give them is information about things that are of interest to the Potter fans. So we'll report about it as far as we possibly can from both sides. And for his part, Steve is... more than welcome.
Yes.
More can continue to be welcome on the Canon Conundrums. As per usual, there's nothing that said he can't, and we still think he's a
pretty
smart guy and a worthwhile addition to that segment, which you all would probably agree. And with that, we're going to hear from some of you guys about the topic we chose for our Bit by Bit, our Seven Harrys, with your fan thoughts.
Hi, this is Samantha subbing this week for Kimmy Blair. This week we are going to listen as Ashley, known as Chocolate Is Not for Breakfast, Owen, known as Nimbus XL, Sarah, known as Stamscow, Libby, and Julie, known as Amina, are going to discuss the next bit of Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows. Now let's listen to their fan thoughts as they talk about Chapter 4, The Seven Potters, and Harry's escape from Privet Drive.
Chapter 4, The Seven Potters, that had me so frightened. I've never been so scared reading a chapter of Harry Potter in my entire life. I was sure, having so many people, that somebody was going to die. The whole time, after they transformed and after they got on their broomsticks and got on wherever, I was like, you knew that they were going to be attacked because of the first scene when Snape was talking to Voldemort. You knew that something was going to happen, and so it was kind of like this tragic, like, don't go, I know something bad's going to happen.
This chapter was a nice mixture of humor and action. Some of the funniest moments so far in the book occurred when six different characters compared what it's like to be Harry Potter. The chase was almost film-like in its writing, describing the action with great sense of adrenaline and suspension. Loved it.
Talk about an action sequence. Even though we were told firsthand about Voldemort's plans for Privet Drive, I was still shocked when Harry was attacked the second he left the boundary of Lily's protection. That part was all a blur to me the first time I read it, and I almost missed the fact that Hedwig died. I was like a full paragraph beyond it, and I'm like, whoa.
Once again, the humor in this chapter is brilliant. When they get the Polyjuice potion out, and Hermione says, Harry, you look tasty, you can imagine the look on Ron's face when she says that. And then when she tries to defend herself about why she said it like that, you can just kind of see her blushing as well. When all of the Order members and Ron and Hermione come in, it was interesting to see how they were willing to go through such lengths to keep him safe so they could have a hand in helping him make the world a safer place for everyone.
Chapter 4 was my favorite chapter of the first half of the book. The first half of it was so funny when the six doppelgangers were just stripping down and Harry was like, hey, give me some privacy here. And of course, Fred and George were terrific as always. And Hedwig gets killed. I think that's the first time I got choked up while listening to it. I could not believe that the fourth chapter and this little character that just means so much to Harry is dead.
Well, here we are, Sue, with Bit by Bit.
Yes.
Well, for this week, tackling some canon a bit at a time. I have some pretty cool canon, actually. Some of my favorite canon of Deathly Hallows at the time that I was reading it at that point.
Yeah. That's clear.
Because it's very cool. And we have some friends. We have some guest hosts.
Ooh, who could that be?
That are very familiar faces to Leaky Staffers, especially myself and Sue and Melissa.
Yeah.
But they are Lizzie and Chloe. Say hello.
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 Yay. We love them.
And Chloe helps me out with all the crazy email you guys sent, and Lizzie helps Melissa, and you're good, smart girls here, so this will be some good segments, right, guys?
Yeah, hopefully.
I don't doubt it. So who wants to tell us what we're talking about?
Well, this is the chapter it's chapter 4 in the book, The Seven Potters, and this is where we have just left. The Dursleys have gone. Our little friend Dutters is now gone. And Harry's zooming around the house, right, ladies? And he's looking around,
yeah.
And it's all gone. It's all his. It's the last time.
So sad.
Was it? Did you feel sad when you were reading it?
I thought it was sad because he's looking at the cupboard and he's talking to Hedwig. He's like, I used to sleep there.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You're remembering back through all the books and there's all these different moments he goes back. And it's kind of like a recap for the fans. It's sweet.
And then you have your Hedwig mentionings, which, of course, we know what happens there.
Oh, don't go there.
Like, Hedwig, are you sure that you don't want to go out for a hunt? Hedwig's like, yeah, I'm tired. And that was her downfall.
Oh, no.
Very sad. Well, I'm getting ahead of myself, aren't I?
Yeah, just a little bit.
Can I just say one of my favorite lines that Jo wrote, the way she wrote this chapter, is like she comes in and like Harry's looking through, like you said, he's looking through the house, and all of a sudden, boom, you know, there's the disillusionment charms had been lifted.
Yeah.
There's like this sight. You can imagine in your head. And she writes how all the people get out and they off their brooms, off the thestrals. And then she talks about each of their hairs. And just the way she wrote that sentence, I know just because I'm a squirrel, but the way from a grammatical point of view, that was really kind of cool. Like Ron, you know, Hermione or bushy hair tied back. And she just described each of their hairs. And I just thought it was kind of funny. I don't know.
They were like warriors. Almost.
Yeah, yeah, like doo-doo, like the,
like
the,
and then the
what do you call
corner.
Them, the Dirty Dozen or somebody showing up? I don't know. Ba-da-da! I don't know. Okay.
Weighing in at 150 pounds, red hair, 6'1", Ron Weasley.
You know, I don't know. What'd you guys think? Because I didn't know what to expect at that point. I was like, all right, rock. Here the hell are. There's Mad-Eye leads in charge, man. And I was like,
oh, jeez, Mad-Eye.
Yes.
I reread that tonight, and that made me really sad. But,
yeah.
The Mad-Eye made you sad? Mad-Eye was close to your heart, was he?
No, but just rereading it and looking back.
That's true.
Because I like how they describe him in that chapter, where I think they call him a warrior or something, don't they? Doesn't she? I think
so.
Well, later, the next chapter is actually called Fallen Warrior, but yeah.
Yeah. But when he lands, that's how they refer to him. Where when they're describing everyone's hair, he's got like the warrior stance or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Kind of like, you know, the Clint Eastwood or something, like, you know, just got off his whole hey, partner.
Yeah, that's exactly Mad-Eye Moody.
Totally.
I don't know.
So all these people show up with their brilliant plan, which was not to polyjuice Harry to be Piers Polks and drive away with the Dursleys, but to polyjuice all of them to look like Harry,
yes.
Which was pretty dang funny. And I'll let your dirty minds wonder why.
Everyone everyone else is commenting, like Ron's commenting, oh, I knew you didn't have that tattoo, and they're all making their various comments, and then Hermione's just concerned that she can't see properly.
I know, you'd think she'd go right for how big her feet were, but anyway.
But thank you, John. You know what I thought was just as funny, though, that was the humor in the line. So, like, she was talking, you know, like, because, like, Harry at first was, like, protesting, and, you know, if you think I'm going to let you risk our lives, and, like, Ron's little comment, yeah, because this is the first time for all of us, you know? I mean, just yeah, slam. Too fast to earth for Harry, you know? Could be noble, but, you know, whatever.
Hero Harry.
It's funny.
Yeah. And the part where, you know, Ron having roomed with Harry for how many years now? That didn't know if he had a tattoo or not, but Ginny knew, because Ginny has been everywhere, apparently, so it's common knowledge there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Hilarious.
You know.
So, these guys, they take off from the little transformation, and Harry gets paired with Mr. Hagrid on the bike.
I thought that moment was really sweet, since, you know, we first see Harry coming in with Hagrid in the first book.
Yeah.
And so Hagrid is the one to take Harry away from Privet Drive for the last time.
That was a brilliant point, too. That was something I remember thought was pretty dang cool.
Yeah.
But things did not go to plan.
No, I was just happy that Sirius's bike was back, because we had been wondering, you know. I was like, sweet!
With modifications.
Yeah, Arthur, baby.
Gotta love Arthur.
Gotta get the fire, get it, that muggle juice powered up, you know.
What were all the modifications? They can send stuff out the exhaust pipe, like brick walls and things?
Brick wall, dragon fire, I think.
Can I just tell you what a goofball I am, but when I was reading that, I don't know, maybe many a European audience won't know this, but there was a show back in the 60s called Batman, and they used to have this thing called the Batmobile, but it was like campy and stuff,
yes.
And it would blast stuff out all the time, and I'm reading that, like, about the thing, and I'm thinking, I just kept thinking, Hagrid has his own Batmobile, I don't know. And I just had this image of him, like, whipping along up there, you know, and he's got his little goggles on, his red bearing look going on. I don't know. I'm a goof. I don't know.
Yeah.
I just thought this whole chapter was so vividly written, you know, just kind of. Quiet.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll be quiet now.
Yeah.
It was awesome, though. It was cool that he got to ride that thing, and for us to realize that there are limits to, like brooms, for instance.
Yeah.
I don't think that was something we knew. Like, we figured a broom could lift up anybody, but apparently not people as big as Hagrid.
Couldn't they have made him a really big broom, though?
Yeah, that would be really funny looking. I don't know if Nimbus is going to, you know, they'd probably charge quite a hefty fee for that.
The Nimbus giant line. I can just see it now coming soon.
Yeah. Can't really mass produce those things, too. Well, can you see a grop? What would grop do with a broom, man?
Oh, he'd eat it or use it as a toothpick or something.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
You'd give it to
whack
Hermione.
People with it. Yeah.
You know.
Or you'd have a very scared, confused flight somewhere and knock something over, no doubt.
That would be sad.
Yes. Well, what did you guys think when immediately they're surrounded by Death Eaters?
Oh, my God, that was so scary.
I was on the edge of my chair reading that through the entire thing, and like I was expecting something like that, but I didn't think it was going to be that big right off.
Yeah.
You know, so soon in the book.
Well, what struck me was that if I remember incorrectly, the first chapter of the book, you know, Snape's giving this information, and you're thinking to yourself, from book 6, oh, Snape, you know, everybody thinks he's bad, but he's really good. You wait and see. We're going to find out he's good. And then the information that he gives about Harry is proven to be true. So you're like, holy crap, why did Snape do that? Is Snape bad? And that's what I was thinking on top of everything else. It's like, oh, geez, what does this mean now for Snape? And we find out later, of course, but it was very, very cool idea to on her part to not immediately make it obvious one way or another with him.
Yeah.
She's so sneaky.
She's clever, sneaky.
Little tricky one, yes, she is.
Yeah.
But then, I mean, like you said, I mean, here come the Death Eaters, and then suddenly, blam! You know, they're right on him, and here's Harry trying to do his, you know, sort of spells or Wingardium Leviosa, trying to save Hagrid or Hedwig. I mean, and
that didn't work. So not too far into it, we lose Mad-Eye.
Yep, we don't.
We lose Mad-Eye.
Can we talk about Hedwig?
Yeah, have a moment of silence.
I was getting to that.
Hedwig's first, and it's just so...
Yeah, well then, after, you know, we don't know about Mad-Eye, but we do know about Hedwig. Yeah.
Hedwig was the death that made me realize, oh no, no one is safe. Everyone is just up for grabs.
Yeah.
I kept thinking, who's going to die next after
it
that?
It just felt so mean.
It was so hard. I was bawling my eyes out at that when I read that Hedwig died. I just had to stop, and I just,
yeah.
I was just shocked.
Yeah, I didn't realize it happened at first. I had to reread that two or three times before it really sank in. Like, holy wow, she just killed Hedwig. That was amazing.
Yeah. I think, if I'm not mistaken, while we were reading that for the first time, that was one of the points that we got up and went to the video camera and started getting all kinds of pissed off.
Yeah.
Like, I can't believe they just killed Hedwig. So, right before we sat down to read the book, I was joking around, like, saying, like, I knew all these spoilers. And I'm like, Crookshanks kills Hedwig on page 102 or something.
God.
And I'm like,
He did. He was goofing around.
Yeah.
He really totally did.
It was not Crookshanks. Who would have thought Hedwig would die, though? That's a big joke of it. Hedwig's going to die, and then boom.
I know. Hedwig was the one constant that was with Harry.
Yeah.
Them all. I mean, there are still a few sanctions out there, sects who believe that perhaps Hedwig was crossbred with a phoenix at some point, and that perhaps Hedwig may indeed be alive.
Yeah. You think? There's a little random faction that's in denial. That's just...
Yeah, that'll be a topic for a future two-part episode at some point. But
special Hedwig experts.
Yes, we will bring in all the best Hedwig experts from around the fandom.
Yeah.
And debate that in a special 3-hour edition of podcast.
Yeah.
I can't wait for that one.
Yeah, but for the sake of today, we'll leave it at that. Hedwig gets it right in the face, and Harry's very distraught about it.
Oh, of course. But then you're surrounded in the face of one trying to, like, not fall out of the little car thing or whatever.
Yeah.
You know? And then his friend Hagrid. I mean, you have to focus on your own survival, too, and it's just a terrible thing. I mean, but I thought that Joe did a really good job of describing that, how those kind of war situations, because this is what it was, was like that, and you have to do that. And so he had no time to really grieve for this beloved creature, and it just happened so fast, and I just thought that was...
Yeah. Well, because he's got Voldemort coming after him at this point.
Yeah.
Voldemort is coming around is what causes all this stuff to happen.
It does. And I got to...
Flying Voldemort.
There, when I was reading this, because I remember, you know, having done all these podcasts with Mr. John Newey, and when I got to page 60, and all of a sudden they're flying, I read the line, Voldemort was flying like smoke in the wind without broomstick or thestral to hold him. I almost fell out of the couch that I was sitting on, because I just was like, John was right.
I mean, it is pretty freaking insane. Because you can't, if you think about it, Voldemort, in all his glory, isn't going to, like, rely on some shoddy piece of equipment like a broomstick.
Mere muggle invention.
You know? You can't see him riding, like, pretty much like a toy. Like, the kid learned to ride in school. He's not going to do that. And he's not going to depend on a magical creature because he hates magical creatures. He's better than them. So if anyone's got to come up with a way to fly on smoke, it's Voldemort. And how freaking cool is that? Because he even heard, like, later, some of the guys were all like, did you see Voldemort? He can fly now. And it's like, oh my gosh, this must be like a very rare thing.
Yeah.
You never heard of anybody being able to do this before.
That was one of the scariest moments in the book. Just picturing that whole scene with him, like, flying was like, ugh.
Yeah. I can't wait to see that, though.
Oh, that's going to be amazing.
Oh, my God. This whole scene, I kept thinking to myself, movie.
Yeah.
This is going to be the coolest opening sequence to a Harry Potter movie ever.
Yeah, ever.
Ever.
Hands down. That's going to reel everybody in. I mean, compare that to Harry on the swing set with Dudley in Order of the Phoenix.
Yeah.
or this. It's like, oh my God, this is so cool.
Yeah, and I actually thought that they might actually start the movie with this and skip the Dark Lord Ascending chapter. I actually think, you know, and then like they'll go back and pick it up later, because I mean, this would just be a heck of a way to...
It'd be cool. I mean, that's fine. I mean, you can go out of order. It wouldn't really change anything.
No, it really wouldn't. It should be like a chance for them to do, like, I don't know if anyone has seen the James Bond films, and they're notorious for their having this fabulous opening scene. And this would just...
Totally.
Chewie, I think this qualifies for that, but
it would kill. I mean, you can't start the book with an obituary in a movie.
No. Yeah. Pretty much a
bummer. People be like, what's going on here?
No, I mean, but it's a murder that happens in the, you know, with the murder of Charity Burbridge, but I mean.
That's true. Everybody always overlooks that, and I just did it too. Yeah. It's like, what did Joe say? She's like, everybody's so upset about Hedwig, but I murdered a human being in the first chapter of the book. Like, well, we don't know who the hell that is, Joe.
Yeah.
We don't care about some new character you introduce for two pages and kill.
Yeah.
I mean, what the hell?
Did you guys so think, though, so we're back on the Seven Potter. This is going on. Here we have this flying lunatic madman Voldemort zooming after him. And then you could hear, and then Joe writes the words, Avada, and I just wanted to, like, just, I just, like, close my eyes. I almost didn't want to read the next, because I was, like, afraid. Yeah. I was like, I just didn't know who it would be. And then.
Yeah. Well, we have this crazy crap happening with Harry's wand.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. Dude.
Yes, good point.
Which is so screwed up.
Yeah.
I had no idea what the heck was happening there. Because you're almost like, what's going to save Harry now this time? Because surely, you know, he hasn't figured it out to do it without any luck. Mm-hmm. And here his own wand comes to the rescue.
I still don't understand how that happened, though. What was that? Like some crazy magic reaction or something?
Well, it's something that was unique to Harry and Voldemort's wands. And not even Voldemort's wands. It was Harry, when they had their big thing in Goblet of Fire and their wands connected and stuff, and the brother wands, and Harry's wand basically saw Voldemort as his mortal enemy. So whenever it's, you know, around Voldemort, even though Voldemort was using Lucius Malfoy's wand, it knew that Voldemort was there and acted that way on Voldemort. And that was the big wonder until Joe explained it more in, like, interviews, because it's like, does that mean Harry's wand is just this powerful now against anybody? It's like, no, just Voldemort, and he's dead, so that power's gone.
Yeah.
But it was very cool.
Yeah.
And freaked Voldemort the hell out.
Yeah, it did, didn't it?
Yeah.
It really did.
Can you imagine him being like, what the hell is this? I've been studying magic for 80 years, and I've never seen this crap, and it's always this kid. What the hell?
You think he'd learn.
He's going to be like having a Charlie Brown moment there, because it's like, why does it always happen to me? What the heck?
Can you compare Voldemort to Charlie Brown?
Oh, a very evil Charlie Brown.
I mean, he is so not Charlie Brown. Charlie Brown is lovable.
They've got the same hair almost. Charlie Brown doesn't have much hair.
There's Slytherin Charlie Brown.
Yeah, he's rocking
I can't
goth
believe
look.
You have besmirched a beloved character like Charlie Brown by calling Voldemort
Charlie Brown.
I
don't think
Charlie Brown was to dress up for Halloween. He could pull it off.
I guess it's that bald head that they both have in common. Is that it, John?
Exactly.
Oh,
quite larger.
Yeah, I'm not sure anyone would dare to pull the football out from Voldemort, though. That might be
no.
Well,
exactly. Voldemort would kill him on the spot. But. Oh, God.
But then,
anyway.
And then, so after Charlie Brown Voldemort disappeared, then that last chapter, I thought that Hagrid was dead.
Oh, yeah.
I really did.
Follow the bouncing Hagrid. I made me wonder, it's like, is there a reason we literally learned the Neville story about how he fell out of his window and bounced all the way along the ground?
Point.
So how the hell can somebody survive a fall like that unless they've got some sort of magical blood?
Well, I think she said once before that you know, like, I think maybe it was earlier in Half-Blood Prince or something that this, or maybe it was Goblet of Fire, or no, Order of Phoenix, when they try to take McGonagall and, like, the Aurors, Dalish, were trying to, like, attack him, and the spells were bouncing off of him because, like, his giant
blood. He is
blood.
Tough guy.
No, like, she said something about the giant blood is more magical or something that,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe
and that makes sense, too. I mean, I think they probably have a similar... magical protection against what would be considered a death Muggle causes.
Oh, yeah.
Like
yeah.
falling like that. Yeah. But, I mean, there's limits to that, and probably the limits are expanded for a giant. But, like, when Harry was falling in Azkaban, and he had to have his momentum arrestriode carry
out.
Yeah, thanks to the wandless Dumbly. You know, you can't survive forever a fall like that, but didn't we learn that you can? There's ways to survive it magically, but Hagrid didn't know how to do it, like... Something of, what do they call it, like a cushioning charm?
Oh,
or,
yeah,
or,
that's right, yeah.
No, it was like an impedimenta.
Impedimenta is when you slow him up, right? Or trip him or something.
Yeah. But yeah. I don't know. There was something that he could have done, just didn't know how to do it, but he survived anyway. Hagrid survived every possible thing in this book. For no good reason. I mean, he's got the castle falling on him and
he
gets trampled.
He can't die. He's Hagrid.
The giant
gets,
who would not die.
I know. All the centaurs run over him. It reminded me of the South Park episode when they purposely try to not kill Kenny. And he's like, you think Kenny? Oh, they killed Kenny. But no, he didn't. He's all right. He didn't get electrocuted this time. Oh my God! Nope, he's fine.
And South Park is not for children. We just don't recommend that for younger children. But I'm just saying that that episode was funny, and you remember that. Oh my God!
Yeah.
So I'm doing. Okay,
breathe. But so our next chapter, the Fallen Warrior. At this point, we don't know who the Fallen Warrior was. I think I actually paged ahead by accident right after they killed Hedwig.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, how nice of them to have this nice service for Hedwig. Because she was a warrior to Harry. She was a fighter.
She was.
But alas, it was not about Hedwig.
I thought it would be about Hagrid. At that point, I was like, oh my gosh, it's a
hero. That was probably purposely done, too.
Oh, I'm sure it was.
Evil.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. After Hedwig had died, I went, okay, that's it. Hagrid's gone now.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you said it was a bloodbath, right? Were you guys expecting that? I mean, you know, when you were reading that.
I would have been awfully quick to lose Hagrid, but it would have been very pronounced, you know, it would have been very intense. And it was almost like for a few pages we thought he was dead, so it had the effect, you know?
Yeah.
And at least you feel it, and then you're brought back like, oh, thank God, Hagrid, but oh, Hedwig. But we got an awesome topic for next week. This topic ran long because, hell, it's an awesome topic. That's still probably one of my favorite parts of the book.
Yeah,
is
mine
that,
too.
Is that sequence there. So very cool.
Well, thank you, ladies.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
This is fun.
Yeah, it's very
fun. Let's take a quick break to play some 5-second clip of the soundtrack and come back and talk about Phoenix Files. Sound like a plan?
Sounds awesome.
Sounds good.
I believe he who must not be named is back. And I believe you fought him and escaped from him.
But here we are. It's the Phoenix Files. It's the time where we talk about the Order of the Phoenix film. And we haven't done this in a while, but to refresh you guys, we've been taking it a few minutes at a time, 10 minutes, 6 seconds, doesn't matter. Last week we talked a little bit about Umbridge and things, and this time we are going to dig in and talk about... voiceover Harry as he writes Sirius, walking down the hill, being an emo little guy, emo teen, and finding fellow emo teen. Actually, she's not really that emo, is she?
No.
But our new good friend, Miss Looney Lovegood.
Hey.
Sorry, Luna Lovegood, trying to turn the Thestrals into vegetarians and failing miserably.
I loved that scene.
But cute scenes. So what do you guys want to, what's your favorite part of that moment here, Lizzie?
I just love that we really got to see Luna, and she's really introduced, and I love Ivana, so it was just great, and I loved how she, you know, she gave the Thestral an apple, and the Thestral was like, what is this?
Like, what are you trying to do, poison me? And then she, like, randomly has a piece of liver in her pocket.
Yeah.
She was ready for it. I don't think Luna always carries her own red meat, but I think she knew she was going to feed the Thestrals that day and was prepared. She probably had it in a little Tupperware that we didn't see in her purse. Otherwise, that's just highly unsanitary. I don't care what magical blood you have.
Yeah, no, can wizards get E. coli?
I don't know. There's probably some like Wingardium Coleitis spell that gets rid of it. But yeah, it was pretty much a Luna scene, wasn't it? That scene was for her.
Yeah. Can I just say from a point of view, like, because I love special effects and you know that's what Mr. John's doing, but I just thought the Thestral and the baby Thestral in that scene were awesome.
Oh, those were amazing.
Oh, yeah. That
I want
awesome.
A baby Thestral.
And for...
Like, I would write a disco.
Well,
that would be amazing.
Yeah. I think, if I remember repeating the interviews correctly, the director's call to, you know, include this kind of stuff in the scene was that he wanted the Thestrals, really emphasize that the Thestrals were, you know, gentle creatures and really contrast them from other scary-looking creatures like the Dementors and things. To have, you know, when you show a baby of anything, it's not, it has to be cute. It doesn't matter. It could be a baby, you know, slug. And somehow we find something cute about this. So it works, and everybody was falling in love with the cute baby Thestral boy. She was right. They did an awesome job. Mm-hmm. On those creatures, and you know, it's as great as they did overall. It can't be said for all the other effects in the movie.
Yeah.
So they awesome work. I forget which studio was responsible for the Thestral.
They did a fantastic job.
Though.
They were perfect.
I thought
ILM, but
I might have. Yeah, I'm thinking ILM too. They usually get stuff like that.
But might be moving pictures, but I don't know. It was excellent, and it just seemed really real. And I thought they did a good job, like interacting with it. You know,
yeah,
like it kind of backed up an actor, and that's a hard thing to do because they're just. Like when they did with Dobby, it's either on a stick or, you know, when they make movies or something. And just the two of them just had a really good. But I think Ivana would be fun to work with. I just think she seems like a really kind of cool person.
She seems like a fantastic.
Well, I mean, she picked up on all this.
She seems like a great best friend. I would just want to sit down and, like, talk with her for an hour about random boyfriends and girl talk and gossip. She seems like the best person to do that with in the entire world.
No, she's, she did a fantastic job. I mean, it's funny, like, it's such a common thing you're hearing in the reviews. It's like, oh, you know, a little hard to follow. They cut a lot of it out, but Luna Lovegood was great.
I loved her lack of
right,
shoes.
So.
That was so cute.
That was hilarious. It made me wonder how cold it was outside. Because they're in northern, you know, wherever, Scotland.
Yeah, because they were wearing coats
we
and
presume.
Things, weren't they? It's been a while since I saw it, but I think she was wearing a coat or something, and then she's just randomly barefoot. Gotta love her.
And she doesn't care. It's like, I mean, because of the students, it's not that she's like some kind of weirdo. The students stole her shoes.
Yeah.
And she comes out to play the Thestrals anyway. She doesn't mope about it in her room. And it's such contrast to Harry, who came out there to mope.
Right.
He wasn't expecting to find Luna. He came out there to be a little emo teen. And who does he find? But the person who, you know, gets about as much crap as Harry does, different sorts of it, but... Look how she deals with it. She goes out and hangs out with the Thestrals. And she cheers up Harry somehow. She gives Harry some perspective.
Awesome. And it was such a nice scene, too, the way that, you know, she did that. And that the filmmakers decided to keep that little, seemingly minor thing about them taking things from Luna and really showing that there are other people in the world that suffer in different ways. And, you know, sometimes we all get caught up in our own emotions and our own problems, and it's so easy to do. And then when you go out, especially when, you know, like, just growing up is such a hard thing. And then you go out, and then, like you said, Harry was all just like, you know, life is but you could just see, like, the big cloud of doom hanging over his head, and then he realizes it. And I just think that was really a well-done scene on that context right there. And I, because I wondered how they were going to show, you know, all cap Harry and angry Harry and just all emo Harry.
Yeah.
You know, and it was a good scene the way they handled that. I don't know.
It's hard. It was hard, I think, to portray that with, you know, this medium is because we don't get Harry's inner monologue and we don't get anything like this that, you know, you'll get a little more in the books. And they had to use the technique they did to do the serious letter, which explains a lot in that moment because the students aren't as critical of Harry in the film other than that one scene in the common room. And we don't really see a lot from the Daily Prophet that's getting on Harry's case. So it's to get the same message across that the book does about why this is such a difficult year for Harry and what's going on, You know, you have to be very clever about how you get that through there.
Yeah, they did a good job there. And then I think this scene is also kind of important for later on, because, like, in the seventh book, we see that Luna having friends is a big motivation for her with her ceiling, her beautiful ceiling. But this is kind of sets up that whole she's not exactly the most popular kid in the world thing that goes with, I guess, through all seven books, or the three books we see her in anyway.
Yeah, totally.
I just loved her. I just loved her voice. I can't rave about her enough.
Everybody gets on her case about, why are you guys always talking about Nirvana? It's like you guys think that, you know, she's this and this and this. It's like, well, come on, guys. She is the, it's like, a lot of Harry Potter fans out there have their stories about why they're Harry Potter fans and how they got into the fandom and stuff. But no one has a cooler story
than
this.
Yeah, she's like one of us.
She's
exactly
She likes podcasts. She likes the websites and all this stuff. You know, she was a fan like us before she was anything else. So why not support her?
Absolutely.
And she's a sweetheart. So yeah, no, I mean,
what
this cat, it was an accomplishment. Yeah, I mean, if anybody's going to speak up on the set when something wrong happens, or you know, you can count on her to do as much as she can.
And she's the one that's living what we wish we could do.
Exactly.
We all wish we could act, you know, in the movies. And she got it. And she's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, my acting skills are pretty phenomenal. I
if
gotta
you
say,
say
it.
So yourself.
I just couldn't get... I couldn't get the accent down, and they wouldn't have me. I was even going to, you know, falsify my birth certificate, but they caught me. They wouldn't let me out.
What were you going to be, Janita? No way, is that a...
Why would I be a woman? There's loads of roles in this book. What is wrong with you?
He was British. I see what you're going for.
It's hard enough to play English, but to play a female English is impossible.
Did you see him in a blonde wig with little earrings?
Yeah, I was going out for Pansy Parkinson, but they'd already cast that upon me.
Sorry, John, I couldn't resist. That was just too.
It was a brutal day.
That's what friends are for, dude. Torture you when you're down.
Oh, God. Okay. Life's sad. But, anyhow, what do we have up?
She skipped.
Did we miss anything?
Did she say pudding in this scene? No, I've forgotten. I mean, I don't know. The whole little pudding.
No, that was the beginning. That was the beginning of the movie. She's like, oh, there's pudding. Yeah, she's good at the icebreakers. So anybody remember what they do next week? Or the next scene? Any girls remember?
Isn't it Umbridge and McGonagall having it out?
Right. They get on the steps and they, you know, have a lady fight.
Yeah.
To be polite. And
he has such a way with words.
And Umbridge decides to set up the Telltale Group. And all the Slytherins raise their hands because they have nothing better to do in this movie.
They have nothing better to do, period.
So, wow.
Have to get Tom Felton in there somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, other than all of the partying that they're no doubt doing because they're awesome.
Partying like they're evil.
But, partying like they are evil.
Rockin'!
Yay!
Yes.
Ryan and Bradley.
Trying to dodge the 99 Death Eaters.
Oh, ding, 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 Mr. Quick.
Look at me. I know a Wizard Rock song. I know a song. That and he's not a boy, you don't belong here, you're not a boy.
I love.
That's my song right there. I love that one. I know all the words, as you can tell.
Yeah, you're excellent, John.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much, ladies, for joining us this week.
Well, thank you for having us.
You did a killer job, and Lord knows you guys are always around to sub in if we need you last minute now that Melissa has bailed on us. So you guys may be hearing from them again. So thanks so much.
Thanks. Yeah.
Thank you. It was fun.
All right.
Bye,
take care
guys.
Now. Bye-bye,
bye.
Then.
Bye.
Welcome to Scribby 5, the 5-minute podcast for Scribulous, the Leaky Cauldron's premier essay project. I'm Erin, or Calpheus on the forums,
And I'm Linda, known as Mosaic on the forums. Today we're going to be talking about The Virtue and the Viper, The Heroic Severus Snape by Ann Arthur. And this is in our latest issue, issue 19. So I'll give you a little summary of the essay in case you guys haven't had a chance to read it yet. This is what Anne says about her essay. The treatment of the good characters compared to the bad characters in both the written and spoken words of the author leaves a sour taste in the mouths of many readers. It seems the good characters can do no wrong and the bad characters have no choice but to be bad. Quite often, the choices of the good characters are celebrated and the bad characters receive little or no credit for the moral choices they make, even though their choices are often the most difficult. Nowhere is this unfair treatment more apparent than with he who is named too often, Snape. This essay examines the discrepancies between said frequently discussed person, Snape, choices, and the way he is viewed by the other characters, as well as the author herself.
Yes, I really did like this essay, and I like the author's name. I don't know if Ann Arthur is her real name, but it's like an author, and so I really like it if it is a play on words. And so I also like the essay. What I mostly liked about it was, as she says in the introduction, the stuff about the good and bad characters. You know, the morality of the series is left slightly unclear by Jo Rowling, and I think that is true, and we're all kind of trying to work that out now, and I'm certainly one of the people who's trying to do that. She says in the essay, I am left with a slightly sour taste in my mouth. It is still a good story, but a certain moral confusion, and especially a lack of generosity in the treatment of some of the characters on the bad side, means that it falls short of greatness for me. And that's what the author's opinion was, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, we've actually had a really active forum thread discussing this essay. I know a lot of us have been reading it, even if we haven't commented yet. We've got about 4 pages of comments talking about it. The author is there, too. She's actively discussing issues with posters, so it's really exciting. So if you guys want to be a part of the discussion or just read what other people have to say about this essay, go to the Scribblist section of the Leaky Lounge so you can get there through HP-related discussions and Diagon Alley, and you guys can weigh in on the discussion.
Yeah, I actually just posted on there myself because I was excited about the conversation going on. She introduces the essay and talks about different characters, not just he who we talk about too often here on Scribulous. And so I thought that was actually a pretty good section, although I don't completely agree with her. I actually found the flaws and the moral ambiguity in all the characters, which, you know, Jo manages to create really well, made them more realistic for me, whereas the author really felt that everything fell short for her because it was hard to tell who was really good and who was really bad. She uses quotes on the words, on the terms good and bad when she talks about it.
Yeah, but at the same time, I think that the final conclusion that the author makes is really good because she talks about Snape being heroic, which I tend to agree with, because Snape is a very brave character because of all the good choices that he makes. But, you know, Harry's brave and Neville's brave and all these other characters are brave too. But at the same time, they have people backing them up. They have Dumbledore's army and the Order and all these other people fighting with them. But Snape doesn't have anyone. And the author does mention, you know, no one really knew who Snape's friends were when he was in school. And he was kind of a loner and he doesn't have anyone with him. And when he's headmaster of the school in the seventh book, everyone pretty much hates him and wants to not be on his side, I guess. And the fact that Snape stands up for what is right as opposed to what is easy is even greater and more heroic because he doesn't have all these people with him and he stands alone. And so I think that that is an amazing conclusion. So even though I'm not the biggest Snape fan in the world, I do tend to agree with the author's conclusion.
Yeah, I actually agree with that too quite a bit. The one thing that I was thinking about along those lines is that for me, whereas I really longed for a reconciliation between Snape and Harry too, just as this author did, and we have another essay that also talks about that reconciliation of Snape, of he who we talk about too often, I mean. And so basically, I really longed for that also. I had this idea in my head of Harry suddenly being like, oh, I totally misjudged you, you know, you know, I was so wrong, and Snape being like, boy, I see your mother in you, you know, not just your father, or something like this. But in a way, because we didn't have that, it made his death all the more tragic.
Right.
And in some ways, that was more moving for me. And so I think I actually kind of do like the fact that we didn't, my personal opinion, is that because it was just so much more tragic that way. So that was something I did like about Deathly Hallows.
Yeah. And one thing that you and I were talking about, Aaron, is that, you know, I think a lot of us really like Snape as a character because he is so fascinating and so in-depth. And we tend to think of him as a main character. You know, you have the main trio, Harry, Ron, and Hermione, maybe Dumbledore's up there too, and then there's Snape. But Rowling doesn't really present him like that. He really is a secondary character along the lines of maybe Luna or Ginny or something like that. He's not a huge character. And I think that maybe one reason that some people were a little more disappointed in Deathly Hallows was because they expected something big with Snape. They expected a huge reconciliation or something that we just didn't really get. But I think that that's okay, like you said, because Snape isn't a huge character, and that's all right.
Right. I tend to think that way, too. So anyway, this essay is very thought-provoking, and there's a good discussion on it going on in the forum. So if you want to go read the essay on Scribulous.com and then make a comment in the forum, that would be really great. And we will see you next week.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
And now it's time for Canon Conundrums. Listen in as our panel tries to figure out one specific issue from the Harry Potter canon.
Who could possibly figure that out?
And we're back here with Canon Conundrums.
What's that word?
In other words, we're more confused than we have ever been.
The well-intended Canon Conclusions morphed back to Canon Conundrums equals Canon Conundrums.
Say that three times fast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we are here again, of course, with everybody. Remember Steve?
Mm-hmm. Yay! Hi, Steve!
Yay. And just a little threesome here, but we're going to have some fun talking about... what are we talking about, Steve?
Well, you know, my big question, and I realize this is, you know, just me wondering all these weird things I wonder, but what exactly happened to the Dursleys? And I'm not talking about a year later. I mean, as they drove away, what exactly happened?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, there's Death Eaters all over the place, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, who were they with? Let's see, they had Hestia and...
Yeah, Deedalus Diggle is the big wild card for that one, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you imagine what that car ride was like, Vernon?
Yeah. Well, I like to imagine what it was like back at headquarters before they arranged all this. And they said, let's send Diggle. And they're all laughing. And, you know, ooh, I would love to go, he says.
Yeah. I mean, it just is odd that they go through what they did to get Harry out of there. And they just figured that... all the Death Eaters would ignore the vehicle leaving the area that was supposed to be their house.
Right. Well, you know, and they supposedly gave him enough time to get away, but still, you know.
But, I mean, the fact that Diggle and them were accompanying the Dursleys meant that they assumed that there might be some trouble.
Right.
Right.
So they had some protection.
And, you know, I'm sure they probably cast some protective charms or something, and I just imagine the Death Eaters kind of shadowing the car, you know. I'm going to check to see if Harry is in the car, which I think would have been a really, really good plan. Put Harry in the car.
Yeah.
Totally.
You know?
Yeah,
I think so, too. You know, is there be like a cloak? Because, like, see, Dudley had no magical protection, right? Because he was not, even though they're the same age, right?
Right. Well, yeah, but Dudley is not completely, you know.
But there must have been some sort of shield over that car.
That's what I mean. And certainly they would have detected that, don't you think?
I would think so, too.
Maybe I'm giving too much credit to the Death Eaters, because they're a bunch of idiots.
Was there ever a spell talked about that can determine whether or not a person has any magical blood in them? Like some kind of revealer to be like, oh, just a muggle, ignore it.
I don't know. It seems I'm trying to remember if there's anything specifically like that. But even so, if they would have cast any sort of magical protections, which I think is logical that they would have, you know, you think that would have shown up. I mean, they were only expecting maybe one or two Death Eaters. Did you ever notice anything, with the exception of Lucius and his family, the Death Eaters are all really ugly. What, are they, you have to be ugly to be a Death Eater?
All bad guys are ugly. Look at the orcs.
You know, they all have twisted faces. And,
the Uruk-hai.
Well, they're not exactly orcs. They're just, I mean, what happens if you go to Hogwarts and you're kind of ugly? And you just kind of automatically get put into Slytherin? Is that, you know?
And, who else will take you in?
Well, right.
I guess so. I guess Pansy Parkinson is described as kind of pug-nosed, so I guess that's not...
Well, through Harry's eyes, all the people he doesn't like are going to be ugly.
But that's so funny that all of them. Well, yeah,
they are. They got twisted face, pockmarked face. He's all pathetic, weird looking people. You know, in order to be a Death Eater, maybe they do a transfiguration to make you really ugly and funny looking. You know, then you can be a real Death Eater.
Maybe that evil just kind of wears. I mean, Bellatrix was supposed to be beautiful before she went to Azkaban.
Yeah, see, that's an Azkaban effect. I mean, I think, with the exception of the Black family, because, you know, Narcissa's beautiful, and, you know, Lucius is, you know, well, I don't know if he's beautiful. I mean, you know, Jason Isaacs is a fairly good-looking guy, but...
Yes, he is. Thank you. I'm going to refrain from commenting, but now since it's on the table, he's beautiful.
Just to distill it down a little more, it's a very common thing to have your bad guys in the stories be unattractive unless there's a more interesting way to go about doing it. Like, you know, the Malfoys may have some looks, but, you know, their whole character is outward appearances versus, you know, what their inner motives are and things like that. So that contrast is what's interesting for them. But, I mean, to bring it back to the Dursleys, you know, we got
two or three really ugly people.
Are the Dursleys ever described as attractive people? I mean, really? Yeah. I mean, you got, you know, Petunia is supposed to have like a really long, giraffe, goofy neck, and you know, they never described them in any flattering way. If the Dursleys were really attractive and good old people, we would
just
like them.
Just to clarify here, has this canon conundrum ever suddenly gotten to the point where we're discussing whether the Dursleys are good looking?
Pretty much. At the moment, it is.
That's okay then. All right. As long as we're all kind of on the same page.
So what you're saying is that their ugliness acts as like a death repellent? I mean, if because they're ugly, they cannot be killed?
Oh,
I mean,
no.
Maybe the Death Eaters would look at them and think they were part of the team.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, well.
They're wearing team colors. So anyway, so we've got the ugly Death Eaters on the broomsticks tailing the car. I'm just imagining this now. Daedalus Diggle, you know, is and Hestia Jones are there to protect them.
Yeah.
And what happens? You know, and just imagine that moment.
Did we ever determine where they went? Do you think they stayed in country or they went off to like some island down like the Barbados or somewhere, you know? Or like the St. John, some sort of...
Well, they wanted to get a house in Majorca at one point, so...
Oh, yeah. Well, maybe that's where they went.
No, I think they went to, a safe house somewhere out in the... wherever.
Oh, it would be poetic justice if we ever found out that they went back out to the island
beautiful.
That, you know...
They're at the hut on the rock, sitting there with Hestia Jones and Daedalus Diggle.
What a life.
And the only food they're going to have is whatever the wizards come up with.
Sausages and birthday cakes.
Sausages and birthday cake. Still left there from,
His rock cakes are still around.
I'm sure those are well preserved.
I guess why this is interesting to me, the interplay between Petunia and Vernon is so interesting. I mean, he is the absolute consummate muggle. And she is this, we have discovered, a little bit between the two worlds. Okay?
Right.
And, of course, much further into the muggle direction right now. But she has this deep down knowledge of understanding of the fact that magic is real and things like this. And would there come a point where she would realize that, okay, it is time for me now to embrace the magic world because I need to defend my family. And not that she does magic, but that she, in a sense, stops Vernon, if you will. You know, he's going to be so totally anti. And she finally says, look, we've got to do this. We've got to work with these people. We've got to do whatever they tell us because this, and this. I mean, that's Dudley basically said that.
If Dudley comes around, you know, Dudley allying with Petunia in those views could probably motivate Vernon to be more amiable to cooperating with magical world.
Right. Harry did say in that chapter, say something about the fact that, well, once Dudley wanted to go, then he knew that the victory was his because they were going to do whatever Dudley wanted. And Dudley now, of course, has had the experience with Dementors. But yeah, it's just interesting to imagine the byplay between Vernon and Petunia if she gets to that point where she says, no, Vernon, shut up. You know, we've got to do this. And what would he actually do? How would that go? I just think it'd be a great story, you know?
Yeah, because there was one of the things we learned later when we were there in New York that night is that the reason, you know, that thing that he was talking about was Dumbledore persuaded her to take her in by appealing to that part, you know, to remember that she wanted to go to Hogwarts and stuff. So somewhere probably along that drive, she was probably thinking about that as well and realizing,
I would like to think, because later on we also learn too that Joe, that later that Dudley and Harry ended up exchanging cards and they have like, you know, the family little get-togethers and stuff later on.
Okay, there's another interesting picture. Dudley and his wife and kids.
Yeah.
And Harry and Lily and Albus and, you know, it's like they're all playing together and kind of just staring at each other. You know? We've all had those kind of family reunions where you get together with
your cousins we have.
You hardly know and don't like very much and you sit there and kind of look at each other and...
Yeah.
You know.
Can you imagine that? Like, so there they are all, like, into magic and doing stuff, and there's Vernon trying, you know, Grandpa Vernon,
yeah.
Sitting there.
I mean, because you know how impossible it would be to tell kids at, like, a young age that are growing up in the magical world and to appreciate and to love magic that we're going around your relatives that don't like it, so don't talk about it. Like, don't hover around on your 3 foot off the ground broomsticks that Dad gets you. Like,
And then can you imagine Dudley's kids are going, Dad, can we do that? No.
Yeah, for real.
Yeah.
No. Otherwise, yeah, go ahead. Just don't tell your grandpa.
Well, you know, what's interesting is, do we know if just because somebody is a squib, does that mean that they're incapable of passing down magical blood to offspring that might, you know, show ability? Like, just because Dudley never had it, and you think...
Right, but if Muggles can
use
a witch or wizard, I mean certainly Slim could.
But I wonder if Dudley's kid.
And we do know that Petunia wanted to, so maybe that will from her side, of, you know, her would be passed down. Wow, that would be awesome.
Could you imagine if Dudley's kids was like one of the first other magical kid from that family for a while?
Oh, what if... Vernon wouldn't permit it. Grandpa Vernon would, like, try and squish it out of him.
Anyway,
like,
I'm surprised Vernon is still alive at this point for the heart condition that guy must have. And the stress, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
That guy's popped so many arteries at this point.
That, plus just imagine, you know, him in the midst of a magical battle.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
I do not believe there is no such thing. There is no such. There's no such thing as magic.
He's getting a jet full of it to the face.
Yeah.
But that would be interesting, though, for Harry to be a fly in the room when the first meeting of, like, Harry after all this has happened and, you know, they are finding out what had happened and the great lengths that Harry had gone to actually, like, save the magical world. And that, because Dudley seemed to have some sort of appreciation of what that kind of first meeting was like. That would be really interesting.
Right. And for Petunia to find out, too, just what, you know, the whole story was. Would she then, I understand, you know, Joe kind of gave her the chance to say something and she just couldn't, just didn't. But I think, you know, John, it's like you say, I think there's something inside Petunia which still has that, not only knowledge of, but a certain longing for maybe, for the magical world and for what her sister had.
Yeah. I don't know if Joe intended this or not, but when I read that additional information about Petunia, about things she might have said and how she wanted to get involved, it kind of reminded me of some adults and some parents that I've heard about who had their kids really like Harry Potter, and, you know, they may know people who like it. But they're, for whatever reason, you know, oh, this is a kid's book, I'm not interested in this, you know, I'm above all of this. But, you know, inside's probably very curious as to what, you know, is so compelling about this and may want to get involved with this themselves, but, you know, for whatever reasons they have, are afraid to or afraid to be, you know, admonished by other like-minded people that they know.
Well, and I've heard of lots of people who have been in that situation like what you're describing, and then when they actually read the books, they just can't stop. They read
exactly. I mean, that's what I think she's embodied here with Petunia, is somebody who is, you know, tempted to be involved with something like this, but, you know, they're getting in the way of themselves of discovering, you know, the magic of Potter and all this.
And just think what a broken heart that little girl had when she sent that letter to Dumbledore and got that response.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
You know? I mean, to have actually brought herself to the point of sending that letter and how hopeful she would have been, made contact or whatever, and then to get that letter saying, no, I'm sorry, it can't be. I mean, oh, poor thing.
You know, even that's true. And I know it's amazing that we can have sympathy for Petunia knowing how she was so very unkind to Harry growing up. But yeah, at that same, you know, emotions at that age are so tender and so intense that must have really, really affected her. And when you consider that, it does make her just a slightly bit more sympathetic, although I thought her behavior was abominable. But, you know.
Yeah. I mean, everything she's done to Harry since then loses all the sympathy, I would think.
The kind of things we've been talking about, that feeling of not being able to be part of that, it's still going to be part of her, I think. That, and I know she's been hurt, and I know she, from the way things went and the way things went with Lily and so, but I just think there's got to be some part of her yet that's just longing for that.
Yeah.
It would just be interesting, again, going back to the whole idea of, okay, they leave, they're driving away, the initial rescue, whatever. What happens if somewhere along the line they're chatting with Deedles Diggle and whatever or so, and they say Voldemort?
Right.
All of a sudden they've got snatchers or whatever all around them. I mean, there's so many opportunities during the course of that, you know, book for something to happen like that.
Right. What they could have also put it like in the what's that charm that Hermione did? Maybe they put him under the spell when they couldn't remember that they had a nephew or something.
That, I mean, that would probably be a fair idea at the time.
Just like a temporary thing? I don't know. That's interesting.
I think that, you know, the Dursleys are just another example of characters that, you know, would have made the book 1,200 pages, but there's so much more we could have gotten from them. Because, I mean, I thought again recently about, you know, if they were never presented with Harry, would they have parented Dudley the same way? I don't think so, because I think that a lot of the motivation for the spoiling of Dudley that Petunia does is rooted in, you know, wanting to, you know, reverse the upbringing she had, where the magical child and the one with the talent and the abilities was showered with all, you know, or at least in her eyes, all of the praise. So in her house, she wants Dudley, the ordinary kid, to be the special one. And Harry, the kid with these talents and abilities, to be, you know, the dirt and to get, you know, special attention.
I never thought about that. That's a great thought.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously we're looking at characters in the book. We're looking at kind of cartoony situations. She's so good. I just marvel at the way she's tied things together in seven books. I can't even imagine how she does that. And this is one more example. She's taken these characters who are just cartoons, let's face it, especially in the beginning when, you know, there's only 37. Well, we'll buy two more presents when we go out. Hopkin, is that all right? You know, they're just jokes. But then over the course of seven books, we have these moments, the one with the, you know, the glasses of meat banging them in the head, and the, you know, all these wonderful moments which bring out these characters, and it's amazing how much we can sit and talk for 20 minutes about these basically minor characters in the story, but they're fascinating.
I think one of the cool things that I picked up from actually having the chance to talk to Joe in New York is that a lot of the people, even people involved with, you know, Harry Potter, like, you know, some of the people were kind of joking around about how excited people are getting to meet Joe and hear these things, but they're just people who don't get it. But to Joe, every one of these characters is, I don't want to say like a real person, but it's not silly for us to have Canon Conundrums because, you know, just because it wasn't in the book doesn't mean it wasn't thought about and doesn't mean that it wasn't developed in a way that was used to shape the storyline.
Which is why we want her to publish her notes.
that would be brilliant. But, I mean, it's after you ask her a question as silly as, you know, did Helga enslave the house elves, and she doesn't laugh in your face, and she actually immediately has a thoughtful answer to it. She's thought about all this, you know, thousands more times than we have.
We ought to get her on Canon Conundrums. I'll bet she
oh, God,
some stuff.
She would tone all of us. It would be hilarious.
Pretty much.
So, Joe, if you're listening, here's a standing invite to join us on Canon Conundrums.
Yeah,
we'll try to think of a really good question to ask.
I have about 15 to start with right away.
You know, Sue, you're going to get a phone call now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, me and Joe. Yeah.
Yeah, but John's the one with the knowy lover friend there. The
I'll let you borrow
contact,
her
right?
Skype contact information.
Oh, yeah.
Well, let's hop out of here, guys.
What did we decide now? I just...
I think that they're accepting of... I think that they've had no choice because of, you know, Joe's given us the information that that Harry and Dudley have had contact post... And that, you know, so I think that they've come to a point that they have accepted it a lot more than they did before, but I wouldn't say that they're best.
Yeah.
No.
And that knowing that they did survive that far means that if they were attacked after, the you know, the seven Harrys popped out of there, then it wasn't too serious and that they survived to tell their tale another day.
That'd just be fun to see Deedles Diggle in combat, too, I think.
I'm sure he's,
that'd be awesome.
I'm sure he's awesome. Probably like Flitwick. You know, someone you don't expect to be awesome,
right.
But is totally ridiculous.
Or Yoda.
Yeah, backflipping off the spaceships.
Yeah. You think Diggle is like the Yoda
long.
Of the magic world? That'd be awesome.
Very cool.
I like that
awesome.
I think we need to start a whole new strain of fan fiction about Diggle's Diggle.
He can have his own website.
My new favorite character.
DeliusFan.com. .ws. All right, let's... push on through it here. We got a bit more show to cover, and I think we're going to try to hit up all of these Joe Q&As for the Canon Conundrums here the next few episodes.
Oh, excellent.
Stay tuned.
So
more to come.
Fun.
Wonderful.
All right.
Thanks, Steve-O.
Thanks, Steve.
All right.
Yay!
See you guys.
Woo!
See ya.
Take care. Bye.
Oh, Melvin. Where are you, Melvin? I miss you, Melvin.
Melvin!
Melvin!
I'm coming up.
That sounds, you know, when you, I think, remember how we did the Alvin, the...
Christmas time is here.
So take out the buttermilk.
Our jingle spells this year.
That's a bonus track, guys.
No,
Melvin overruled it.
Drat that Melvin, she's so fun.
Yeah, Melvin and Mooshaka.
Melvin and Mooshaka, that's it.
Mooch, I wasn't saying Mooch Kaka. That's hilarious, though.
She's gonna get
I didn't
me.
Even. Your head went there quickly. Mooch Kaka. I love our new nicknames this week. This is brilliant.
I'm dead. She's going to
get
this.
Man.
Ow. What are you doing? You're supposed to help control him. No.
We're not afraid of no Mooch Kaka. Anyways, what a crazy week. I think we did it, though, and I think we failed miserably. Yeah. Just real quick, I'm confused because a week has gone by and no one mentioned whether or not Dumbledore
what?
Was gay.
He is?
Is it okay if we don't talk about it every week or are you guys going to get upset at it?
I personally...
I think
we're
cool.
Very cool.
I don't think we need to talk. Every podcast about Dumbledore's, you know, sexual lifestyle. But I think he is still gay,
yeah.
So a good double check.
Yeah.
Anyway, fun show, good stuff.
You know.
Any announcements?
No, but you know what? It's November, folks. November. Just saying, it's November.
Oh, it's almost Turkey Day.
I know.
Almost Turkey Day. Hope we all had a fun Halloween. Sorry about our lack of Halloween episode. I was doing homework because I'm hecka lame. And I did do my homework in my Hogwarts robe. Just don't tell anybody. Actually, all you guys think it's cool. Everybody else in my apartment.
I was a Hufflepuff.
That's the beauty of the fandom, guys.
I was in my Hufflepuff, yes.
Were you? Everybody recognized
you.
A
little, 8-year-old boy came up to me and said, Hufflepuffs are cool, too, and he gave me high five. So I gave him extra candy. I was like, yeah.
Heck yes.
And, of course, the other people...
Oh, good. It's good to do that. It's good to give people hope that they might be
you know...
Cool.
I give candy and cookies.
Hopefully we didn't drive you guys crazy.
We were pretty good. Sort of.
But, so, if you guys hadn't figured it out, the whole guest host thing was trying to prepare us for that inevitable day that Melvin would bow out on us. But it came a little sooner than anticipated, so we only had like two or three of you guys in the do it. So we got a couple lined up for next week. It'll be fun, and we might even let the guest host sit in on some of these other segments if they are particularly awesome at it. And
we mentioned too, please don't forget to send in your video blog challenge for our Jingle Spells thing. Yes.
Yes, that is awesome. Jingle Spells video challenges. We've seen some hilarious ones, starting with Mr. Frankie Fraggle Frack.
It's still open. It's still going on. So
who did a heck of a job. Yeah, it is still, yeah. I mean, it's never going to end until the thing's done. But, yeah, it will be cool. And guess what else is still going on that has not been ditched, just has fallen by the wayside of all these other crazy things going on? As our awesome podcast acting troupe.
How splendid, she says in her face.
We have updates on this front. We have decided, by result of lots of discussion, to base our fun little plays in cooperation with our good friends from the Sugar Quill, which is a very well-known Harry Potter fan fiction site. Who, do you know anything more about these guys other than that they have put a big strength in actual universe fan fiction as opposed to the alternate universe?
Really, they're an intelligent site. I was actually the first fan fiction site I read. And our friend Kristen Brown, I believe, does work on there. And they're going to be helping us out. And we have some...
They'll be helping us come up with this script. And we are going to try to have bits of it at the end of every other segment or so, have a poll on Pottercast for you guys to vote on some of the details of the thing. So it's going to be pretty much like your guys' pick, too, your guys' script, too. And we're still trying to figure out how best to audition you guys, and hopefully we'll have that within the next week or so. And let you know if you want to be acting out in a little radio show, podcast style. We'll let you know how to be involved with that. Hopefully in a week or so.
Yeah, Miss Meg is going to be helping out, and I think you guys will be impressed with this. She is one heck of a writer and awesome.
Yes. Very, very talented people working on this script, so it should be quite entertaining. And you shouldn't want to be skipping through it. Hopefully, I don't know. Some of you guys might be all, rawr, rawr, rawr. I don't like acting. Rawr, rawr. Maybe you're welcome to fast forward. But this should be
a lot
of fun.
I love our fandom. There's so many different rockin' things.
Our fandom rocks. But I guess it is that time again to say goodbye to all of Podcast family. P-O-T-T-E-R-C-A-A-S-T, I guess. Is that a copyright? I don't know. I don't know. Podcast.
I got to think of a new cheer. I need to get him up for the cheer.
Forever let us keep our iPods charged.
Okay, should we say keep twiddling those dials?
Oh, that's right. We do that, don't we? We have to remember that everybody needs to keep twiddling their dials.
Our password will be...
Melvin! So you should keep each other safe.
Good night.
Good night.
Bye, everyone. Have a great week.
We've missed it.
W3.
I confess myself disappointed.
Now, if you don't mind, I'm going to bed.
Great Scott, no wonder. Look at the time. We've been here nearly 4 hours. Spooky how the time flies when one's having fun.
This week's podcast was produced by the Podcast Trio and Steve Bonnet. The show was edited by Steed, Hildy, Samantha, and Liz. Thanks to Steve Vanderark for joining us for Canon Conclusions. Thanks to our Scribby 5 team, Aaron and Nina. And thanks, as always, to our awesome transcription elves for transcribing this and all our other episodes on Podcast.com. For more information about the show and how to contact us and be a part of future episodes, visit Podcast.com.